context for the Energy Facility Siting Council has been, I think, fairly well laid out by the previous speaker and by others who've testified to you. Let me just say that C of O strongly opposes the destruction of the need for power approach that Senate Bill 951 entails. We believe that applicants for power plants and transmission site certificates deserve fair and speedy treatment of their proposals, but all Oregonians deserve cost-effective and environmentally sustainable energy projects. The rights of interested people and organizations to intervene in that process must be preserved so that inadequate, expensive, or environmentally harmful applications can be identified and, if necessary, be stopped. We know that the stakes are high when the kind of money involved in these large projects is being brought before the council. Obviously, the applicants are very concerned that they get their applications processed speedily, and plants that are deserving should be approved as quickly as possible so that financing costs can be minimized and so that the benefits can be retrieved as quickly as possible. We also have confidence that the current system of the Energy Facility Siting Council is basically sound, and we recognize that there are concerns about the process, but we think that appropriate streamlining, and we realize that this has been gone through for several years now, but we still believe that appropriate streamlining of the existing process rather than destruction of the need for power standard within that process is the way to go. Secondly, we strongly support continuing the requirement in the state statute as part of the state energy policy and ORS 469-010 and elsewhere that cost effectiveness be the yardstick for energy policy in the state of Oregon for actual decisions relating to energy facilities, conservation measures, and so forth. We can't conceive of any reason why we should drop this. Cost effectiveness, if properly designed and implemented, tells us across a range of energy resources which ones are the best ones to buy, which ones we should purchase first, and which ones we may want to wait for until later. We think that economic theory, common sense, and our own history, which unfortunately has included some rather major energy failures, indicate that cost effectiveness should be retained as the key of energy resource decisions in the state of Oregon. Some have argued that market discipline will provide cost restraint, and thus that provision for energy cost effectiveness would no longer be necessary as we move toward a deregulated energy market in this decade. But we believe this argument fails in three crucial respects. First, most customers of utilities still have no market choice. If you have electric or gas service, you have a single supplier. And thus, we're dependent on those utilities to make smart decisions, cost-effective decisions, wherever possible, in order to provide us energy that we need at the least amount of cost over the longest period of time. Secondly, the interest of energy suppliers are obviously their own and may not include long-term considerations of environmental externalities and so forth. Those things are the kinds of things that are included in the cost-effectiveness standard, or at least should be included in the cost-effectiveness standard that the state adopted and is implemented by state agencies. The third area that we're concerned about is the dropping of the global warming study of the Department of Energy. We're kind of mystified about why this is in the bill, because only this section of the state energy plan is addressed by this bill, and it is completely dropped. I sense from the discussions that we've heard that there are concerns about how that energy study is then dealt with in the Energy Facility Siting Council process. I think we should talk about that rather than simply dropping it simply because it seems to be some kind of inconvenience or raise difficult issues. Now, there's no question that global warming, global climate change, is a difficult issue. I'm not here to tell you that global climate change is happening today. The scientists definitely do not have that conclusion. But they're concerned enough to say that we should be very seriously interested in this problem. And that's the approach that we took in 1989 when we drafted the bill, Senate Bill 576, which then instituted this particular study. We felt rather than coming in with a series of actions that should be taken to address global warming emissions, particularly carbon dioxide, it would be much more important to provide ourselves the education about what's really happening with that issue and then be prepared to take action as appropriate. And those actions might include, for example, modifications to the way the Energy Facility Siting Council process works. But we think that in 1995, given the kinds of news reports that are coming in, some of which I've attached to my testimony, this is not the time to drop that study. It's a very important process that we have to inform ourselves as much as possible about a very serious issue that we face over the next few decades that would definitely affect the state of Oregon economically and otherwise. So that is my testimony today, Mr. Chairman. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Fred. Any questions of Fred right now? All right. Well, thank you for coming. I'd like to wind this up here by 5:30, if possible. So we got two or more bills. We've got a lot of people here waiting. But, Dan Meek?
Good afternoon, particularly to the new senators who didn't hear me here last week. My name is Dan Meek. I'm here representing the Don't Waste Oregon Council. My clients have been the most active in the siting process, starting with its inception in 1975, and I think, modestly speaking, have saved Oregonians hundreds of millions of dollars, if not over a billion. The notion that these are procedural changes to the law is, in my view, not the case. These are very serious, substantive changes. In fact, if you adopt these changes, I would recommend abolishing the Energy Facility Siting Council entirely because it will no longer have a function. As my testimony indicates, what this bill would do, and the Dash 1 amendments are no different than the original bill in this regard, it would eliminate the assured contested case proceeding in the first place. The existing law makes it mandatory. The new bill would make it voluntary on the part of FSEC. It would eliminate the need for power standard entirely. It would basically eliminate all Oregon energy policy considerations in power plant siting, including global warming and including environmental concerns. It would impair enforcement of site certificate conditions, basically removing the authority of FSEC to enforce site certificate conditions. It eliminates the entire concept of site certificate warranties, that is, the promises of the utility or the site certificate holder. By eliminating the stay of the site certificate pending upon a decision by the Supreme Court, it would allow holders to go ahead and build their plants, thereby making it a lot of economic pressure on the Supreme Court to uphold what they do, even though that particular provision probably saved Oregonians $1 billion with the Pebble Springs plant in the 1970s and 80s. I think we should let, in this case, experience be our guide and realize that the fundamental conditions have not changed, that there is not a market system in providing electricity in Oregon or elsewhere in the country. Now, you've heard the industry representatives saying, well, basically, the market has evolved fundamentally in the last 2 years. Well, how it's evolved is a mystery to me. Ms. Kirkpatrick says, well, back in the bad old days, utilities were regulated monopolies with defined service areas and an incentive to overbuild. That's exactly the case today. In Oregon, each utility has an assigned service area in which there is no competition. If you want to generate power or buy power from someone else, you're out of luck. The only one you can buy from under the territorial allocation system in Oregon is the assigned utility. Whether that assigned utility is an investor-owned utility like PGE, PP&L, or Idaho Power, whether it's a co-op, or whether it's a publicly owned utility. So there is no competition. That's why utilities still have the incentive to overbuild. A good example of that is the Coyote Springs plant that PGE is now building out near Boardman. Instead of having any kind of open competition or competitive bidding to decide what was the least cost plant to pursue, PGE decided that it would simply build this plant. And we obtained documents in discovery during the case that indicated that the reason they wanted to build it was to enhance shareholder profits. The only way a utility under the system of regulation makes profits is by owning its own facilities, placing them in rate base and receiving upon them a regulated rate of return. If they go out and buy power from a lower bidder, they don't get that profit under conventional rate making. So they're building the Coyote Springs plant. Now, you've also heard that these plants are smaller than those bad nuclear plants in the past, those bad nuclear plants in which the Northwest wasted over $8 billion and got nothing for it but holes in the ground. And for the senators who weren't here last week, I pointed out that in Washington, during the 1970s and early 80s, utilities wasted $8 billion on terminated nuclear plants. In Washington, there was no mandatory contested case hearing before the Energy Facility Siting Council, and there was no need for power standard. In Oregon, there was a need for power standard, which was invoked in the very first case, and that was Pebble Springs. The council issued a license for Pebble Springs in 1975. That was appealed to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court reversed it in 1977. In 1978, the Energy Facility Siting Council hearing officer concluded that there was no proof that the plant was needed, and as a result, it basically came to a halt. And because of that, PGE and the other utilities in that project were allowed to spend only about $400 million before the plant was stopped. The nuclear plants on the very same timetable as those plants were Whoops 1 and 3, and the utilities wasted $5 billion on those plants before they were finally stopped. And the reason is because there was no Energy Facility Siting Council with a need for power standard in Washington having authority over those plants. Now, the contention is, well, now we're just siting smaller plants. The output of the Coyote Springs plant will be approximately the same as Trojan. Trojan had a capacity factor during its lifetime as 50%. It's about an 1,100 megawatt plant, capacity factor of 50%. Coyote Springs is a 500 megawatt plant with an expected capacity factor of 90%. It comes out to be pretty much the same amount of energy. These are not small plants. Interestingly, PGE obtained the site certificate for the Coyote Springs plant with no gas supply contracted for. Now, you can imagine what's going to happen in the gas markets. If you allow the utilities and independent power producers to build in Oregon what they want to build, which is another round of 4,000 megawatts, it would double the Oregon electric power system. Those are the plants that are queued up at FSEC for approval. Now, if you let them build the plants, and they have no contracts for gas supply, what is that going to do to the price for gas? Well, PGE said in the case, well, we think gas and the gas is going to be very cheap. Canadian gas from Alberta and British Columbia, it's going to be real cheap. In fact, they stated what they thought the price would be. So we said, fine, we'll go away. We'll leave the process if you agree that that's all you'll charge ratepayers for this plant. They said, oh, no, we won't do that. I said, well, what gas price will you assure for ratepayers? And they wouldn't give any assurance whatsoever, which means that they can build the plant with no supply of gas, and then we ratepayers are on the hook because they are a monopoly. We have no choice who to buy power from, and neither do the commercial or industrial customers served by PGE. So it's the same system it was in the 1970s and 80s when we had this huge binge of spending on power plants, wasted $8 billion. They're starting it again. And the fundamental economic conditions have not changed at all. And what's going to happen, I believe, is that these plants are all built, and then the Canadians will sit back and see that the Pacific Northwest has this huge investment in gas-fired power plants, and they need gas for it, and they'll be able to hold up the market for a higher price for gas, and that's what I expect will happen if these plants are built. And in essence, as my written testimony points out from last week, these so-called process changes are substantive. They basically render the site certificate process a nullity, and you might as well abolish the whole process if you adopt the changes suggested by industry. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any questions, Dan? All right. If not, we'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 951, and we'll open the hearing on Senate Bill 1127. Who is our
hearing or work session? You've got listed for work session.
Oh, I'll correct that. It's a work session.
Now,
all right. What do we want to call that?
I don't think you need to call anybody up.
We have some amendments.
We've got three amendments, and I can walk you through those. I have gross. A bill with all the amendments.
All right. I'll ask the committee administrator to walk us through the amendments, and he has provided you with a hand and gross bill. And everybody got their hand and gross bill?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, attached to the staff measure summary is the hand and gross bill. I think it'd probably be easiest just to walk through that. There are three different amendments, dash one, dash two, and dash three. Dash one and dash two were requested by the sponsors. Dash three was based on testimony that we accepted at the last meeting. On page one, line 19, the word hatcheries has been deleted and recreational fisheries is replaced. So it's four individuals representing ocean and inland recreational fisheries. Line 21, it's amended to read, the task force shall develop a fishery-sustaining salmon production strategy plan. Line 23 is amended to include threatened as well as endangered species. Line 24 is added to read, as amended, but will be productive contributors to fisheries. Line 25 relates to productivity again. Line 26 specifies the escapement of adult salmon into watersheds. Page 2, line 14, selected hatcheries is deleted and replaced with improving or expanding fisheries that selectively harvest hatchery-produced salmon. Line 17 is expanded to include supplemental natural salmon stocks through a salmon and trout enhancement program as defined in ORS 496.435 to 4.455. That's the salmon and trout enhancement program in the statutes.
All right.
Line 24 relates to the report back to the legislature. Provisional recommendations will be made no later than March 1st, 1996, rather than the previous date of December 1st, 1995.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Bruce, give me a definition of provisional recommendations as compared to recommendations.
Provisional would be similar to draft recommendations.
Okay. Sounds like very good.
Also on page 2 after line 21, a new section which is handwritten on page 3 is added. The task force may, in its discretion and for reasons given in its final report, decline consideration of the fisheries of the Columbia River Basin, not including the Columbia River estuary, and omit such fisheries from its recommendations. The reason for that was based on testimony we took at the last hearing, where the concern was is that on the Columbia fisheries, due to the overlapping requirements of multiple federal, tribal, and state agencies, and because of the threatened and endangered species issues, that that may be more than the task force wants to take on in this relatively short period of time. And finally, on page 3, lines 10 and 11, the remainder of that sentence has been deleted.
All right. Any questions on those amendments?
Well, Mr. Chairman, just that they're, we left the tribes out. And I think that the tribes are an important component of these salmon fisheries, whether they be on the coast or in the Columbia or whatnot. We've got tribes all up and down the coast, all over Oregon that I think we ought to, sometimes they have some tremendous wisdom, and I think that they ought to be represented.
You mean on the makeup of the task force?
As part of the task force.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we've even left out the OD and FW. I mean, I think the fisheries manager of the department should at least be a part of the task force. I mean, what are they, we're going to have people telling these people what to do and they're not even involved and they're supposed to manage the resource?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Related to Senator Dwyer's question, I put a list of issues that I identified that I think the committee needs to address, and you know, if you bear with me, I could pass those out.
All right.
And
Right, let's look at these then. Get a better feel for this. Is it this committee's intent that this salmon task force is to only address salmon? Or does the committee want to include steelhead and sea run cutthroat trout?
What's the intent of the bill? The intent of the bill is salmon. What does it say? It said, I think it's
Section 1, yes. Term. The goal there is for salmon hatcheries. Just something we need. We don't? Okay. Just. Brenda?
I can have a comment.
Yes, go ahead.
I'm looking at this, and no one is important to the community and the river that is in the river that has managing for a single species is the
Element.
Would there be implications of this for a city to get a trout?
I think generally what would be good for the salmon would probably be good for the others, but do we have fishers in there? Rod, would you please come?
Well, this conflict, I think, with even with the with their plans, or their fish management plans. I mean, they've developed these strategies based on wild fish, natural fish, all these strategies, and now we're going to go completely to a hatchery, give precedence to hatcheries. I got
you don't know that that is the aim. Rod, would you care to address the matter of salmon versus including the others, how much difference that would make? Is what's good for the salmon good for the steelhead and cutthroat?
Probably going to have three different points of view.
Either one of you.
For the record, Mr. Chair, my name is Rod Ingram, Deputy Director of the Department of Fish and Wildlife. I'll give an attempt. I have asked Jay to come up here and bail me out. I think the thing that was being looked at originally is that salmon is also considered a commercial fishery, and it was looking at both recreational and commercial fisheries. When we get into trout and steelhead, we're speaking entirely of recreational fisheries.
Mm-hmm.
If the committee wished to broaden the task to those species, it would be very simple to change this to salmonids, and that would cover all those species.
All right.
Chairman, members of the committee, Jay Rasmussen, the Oregon Coastal Zone Management Association. I concur with what Rod has indicated here. I think the intent was initially to make certain that we recognize that both commercial and recreational fisheries were involved. There had been some discussions at various times of using the term salmonids, and then in the vernacular, in a sense, a lot of times that falls out and you start talking about salmon.
Well, what's the committee's desire?
If we were to change that to
salmonids?
That would not change the intent of this at all.
Go ahead, Chairman. Senator Brecky. I don't think it changes the intent. It may, in a sense, emphasize more the recreational side of that, and it does extend the scope a little bit of what the planning effort would be. Right now, that planning effort would be primarily focused on Chinook and Coho, and by using the word salmonid, you would include steelhead and other other fish.
Question, though.
Senator Dwyer.
But that would give the committee more discretion, but it wouldn't direct them where to go or what to do.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right.
Senator Dwyer, I think that's exactly the case. And I think the committee would have, or the task force would have, some discretion in the sense to say that given the time constraints they have, they may want to focus on several stocks, several species of salmon rather than all of them.
I believe the intent of the chief sponsor was that this would be geared more to commercial, but it doesn't mean we couldn't
What's the feeling?
Well, I don't have any objection to doing salmonoids. I mean, the committee's going to make its decision what's important. Why should we limit?
All right. So we would substitute salmonids for salmon on line 5. Would that take care of it?
I think I'll do it throughout the bill.
Huh?
I think I'll have to do it throughout the bill.
Throughout the bill. All right.
Right. Sure.
Well, in concept, we can do it, and then we can have it fixed.
All right. So, all right.
So salmonid.
Salmonid?
So,
it's salmon.
Number 2, the bill currently... Well, here's our chief sponsor. You want to go up? We're going over some issues here, Senator Bond. And we just made a decision that we would broaden this a little bit to include the other salmonids. And the next policy question is the bill currently requires the task force to emphasize hatchery programs over wild fish programs. This may be in conflict with the salmon and trout enhancement program currently in code. Does the committee want the task force to address this issue directly? That is, does the committee feel the current policy is ineffective and needs to be replaced? Senator Bunn, would you?
Chair, could I comment on that?
All right.
Regardless of what we do, the wild salmon will, on a national level, on a state level, be treated with a very high priority. This is the only place that we are saying very clearly and very strongly for survival of the long-term fishery in Oregon, we've got to have the hatchery component. I would hope that we would keep that strong language on the hatcheries in the bill so that that helps drive the process toward a partnering of the wild fish and the hatchery fish.
All right, agreement on that? Okay. All right. Number 3, there currently exists a statute, by statute, a salmon and trout enhancement program advisory committee. Does the committee want this task force to interact with this advisory committee? Yeah.
You want to explain how they work, Rod? I mean, so we know what this committee is doing, and would what they're doing be in conflict with what these people will be doing?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dwyer, I'll try. I'm not entirely familiar with all their workings, but I don't see this committee being in conflict. I would see them working with this committee in terms of what they're pulling together, as well as the department working with this group as an agency. I think the expertise lies in the department and the expertise in terms of what's going on the coast and the STEP programs. There, I assume that they would work together and they wouldn't be in conflict.
Let the record show that legislative intent is that they would work together then. All right. The bill requires the task force to use general services and legislative staff for the task force staff. It is unlikely that either general services or legislative staff would have either the professional education or experience that will help them provide sound advice or assistance on these issues. Does the committee want ODF&W to provide direct technical assistance to the task force?
Mr. Chairman, I think that they not only should they provide direct assistance, but the head of the fisheries or someone ought to be a member of the task force.